Welcome to the best of the RSN Breakfast Club. Here's a little bit of what we did. Take a listen.
Happy Tuesday, Adam White.
Thank you very much for that, Daniel Harford.
Nice to be with you in your new jumper. It looks nice. Nice work by you. Nice work indeed.
Happy with that one?
Yep. Solid.
Been told that I have to embrace a round neck as opposed to a V-neck. V-necks are more for the 50-pluses.
Is that right?
A round neck is more for a younger person.
See, I would have thought perhaps the opposite.
Well, I would have as well.
One man who knows more about this than you and I put together is a very fashion-conscious man, Jimmy Bartel, Norm Smith medalist, Brownlow medalist, triple premiership player from the Cats. He joins us again. Morning, Jim.
Morning, gentlemen.
Round or V?
Whatever looks good, really.
Thank you, Jim.
And you look good today, Wardy.
Oh, yeah. Fantastic.
No,
look mature.
Mature? Is that the look you're going for? The mature look?
No, not really. Not really. I was involved in a minor incident yesterday, Daniel.
Oh, no. Not another car theft. A car theft that wasn't perhaps a car theft like last week with Andrew Mays.
No.
What was it?
Well, as you know, I haven't got very long legs.
This is a good start to the story.
So whenever I buy a pair of pants,
yes,
I have to go to the person to... So take them up.
Like a tailor.
Like a tailor. Well, it's not really a tailor. It's you go to the shopping centre and you get the people that, you know, they probably are tailors. But I think of a tailor as someone that's got the measuring
tape over there.
They've got pins in their mouth.
The alterations people. The alterations people.
Yeah. Anyway, so I was there yesterday and I decided to go with pants that were just a little bit tight, yes. Because I'm on a regime, so I'm going to really grow into them. So I was in the little sort of cubicle type situation, and had assumed that I'd sort of locked the door.
Oh no!
So I'm trying to put the pants on, and as it was quite a tight, not tight, but uncomfortable type, trying to get them on, I overbalanced in my enthusiasm to try and get the button up done.
It can happen.
And put the hand onto the door just for support to sort of balance up. Burst through the door.
Oh dear.
Into a open shopping centre type plan.
That's awesome.
So it was game on.
Because it wasn't me.
Did you keep your feet or did you go sprawling across the ground?
I didn't keep my feet. Fortunately, I have cat-like qualities and I was able to get to my feet quite quickly. Much to the surprise of the tailor who was, you're ready. So quite surprised by me just appearing.
That's outstanding. The old barge through the door situation. You're very aggressive with your alterations.
Are you on some show or something? You've new jumper, new jeans.
New jumper. That's all.
I must say, having short legs is a problem though. You've got to get every pair of pants taken up. It's a pain in the backside.
Sometimes they cost more than the pants themselves.
It's a pain in the backside. This is why one of the reasons I wear shorts, because you don't need to take them up. They're constant in the right state all the time, Jim.
I do work with three height challenge people, don't I?
Certainly leg challenge, leg length challenge.
Yeah, the R&D man's got shorter legs.
When you go and buy yourself a pair of pants, do you have to get them taken up?
No.
Yeah,
I'm lucky. For my body height, I'm long-legged.
So I have a grandmother who retired from taking pants up of both myself and my dad in recent times.
She retired?
Well, she did. She did.
Was it a retirement or a flat-out refusal?
No, she'd still do it if she could, but she's 95, so she's probably decided
to find somebody else.
Yeah, yeah.
Let Nana do her own thing.
She was doing it until a couple of years ago.
She hung up the needle.
The sewing machine was put away, but that was a bit of a setback because that was done not only free of charge but on demand.
Just come around. Hi, how are you going? Oh, these are here as well.
I was like, I'll put the kettle on, you get the sewing machine out.
Oh, goodness gracious. Jim, you had a good day yesterday too.
I had a great day. My faith in people was restored.
What happened, Jim?
I found my wallet yesterday.
This is amazing what's happened here.
Yeah.
Absolutely amazing.
I still have 14-year-old dweebs messaging me saying, oh, I've got your wallet.
Well, you did put it out on Instagram for anyone to help you find it.
Because I thought...
You're always a chance to get some boffins.
Yeah, because I thought people were nice, not just bullies and making fun of me. Wasn't I wrong? But I also found out a lot of people lose their wallet.
They do.
Yeah, 5 brown wallets were found, unfortunately. None of them were mine.
Oh, is that right?
Yeah, people actually took photos of these wallets they found around the Etihad Docklands area.
Serious?
Yeah, I said, well, clearly you can see their driver's license. That's not me. Maybe contact that person.
Fair point.
Yeah, but no, I retraced the steps, thinking long shot here. 2 days after, couldn't find it. Went to the security there at Etihad. You know, when you drive in the big Bourke Street entrance, they got that little booth.
Yep.
They sent me to security. Security sent me back up to the where all the radio boxes are. Researched that whole level again. Then went down to another reception and thought, you know what, I'm going to go, because I actually called on Saturday, I called all those restaurants and cafes that are out on the concourse there, people at Etihad. I'd actually called them on Saturday and said, no, I haven't found anything. So, oh, I'm here, I might as well just go back in. Got to the Subway.
Yeah,
the one out there.
Eat fresh.
And then asked the lady, then she said, no, I haven't seen it. Just about to go out the door, she goes, oh, I'll just ask the other girl out the back. And
there's the girl out the back.
Yeah, they hide people at the back somewhere. That lettuce doesn't get cut by itself. Anyway, she came out. She's, oh, we used to have a wallet. I'm going, oh, it's not used to. What do you mean? Anyway, she reached underneath the counter and it was halfway up. I go, that's mine.
Oh, you saw it early.
Saw it early. And she goes, I have to ask your name. And I said, oh, that's mine.
Were you a little affronted by that question?
No, I was happy she just wasn't giving away my wallet to anyone.
My face is my badge. What do you mean? What's my name?
I know.
I got a Brownlow. I'm wearing my Brownlow.
I had a V-neck jumper on too. And I actually just jumped the counter and just started hugging her going, oh, you're my favourite person. She didn't touch the wallet or anything. My faith in people was restored.
Is an excellent result. And that precinct to find a wallet, refind your wallet is an outstanding result. Well done to that. Whoever handed it into the Subway.
Young lady, she was fantastic.
So, good stuff.
Did you get a Subway while you were there?
Get a little meatball on the way out?
No, it was a bit early. It was a bit early.
It's never too early for meatball.
No, the bread smelled good though.
Bread smells good all the time there, and there's never a problem for the time of day with a meatball. But there is a problem with the Australian batting lineup as we moved on, Whitey. And I know you've got an issue with where Aaron Finch is placed in the order. He opened the batting in the first one day that Australia lost, and then he comes in at number 5 in the second one, where we lost by 38 runs. England making 342 the other day. We made 304 in reply. The third one's tonight. That's why I bring it up. The third game is tonight at Trent Bridge at 11 p.m. for local guide viewers. What are they doing with Aaron Finch, and why are you so upset about this?
Well, I think they're going to keep him in the middle order. And Justin Langer has spoken about how we need to work out what we want to do with this top order moving forward. So we're trialling a few things. And as a result of trialling a few things, the best opening batsman in one-day cricket who's available for selection is being stuffed around. And Aaron Finch has scored 10 centuries for Australia in one-day cricket. He averages close to 40. He's got a good strike rate, not an outstanding strike rate, but you can build a team around him. And when you've got an inexperienced batting lineup, what you do is you put your most experienced player in the position that he is suited best.
Right, so Travis Head and Darcy Short, who made headlines during the Big Bash last season with his swashbuckling style, were the ones that opened the betting on for game 2. Sean Marsh coming in number 3. Would you switch Travis Head and Aaron Finch?
I think it's a pretty simple thing. What you do is that you put Aaron Finch at the top of the order and you bat him with Alex Carey. Now, that's a little bit problematic.
That's a concern because he's not currently in the team.
No, but he's in the squad.
Yes.
But the issue there is that Tim Payne is the captain, which would mean that probably Tim Payne wouldn't be in the team.
That's correct.
But I think if you were looking at the best case scenario, that would be what it would be, because then it gives you the flexibility to either play another batsman or gives them a chance to play another bowler, because you'd put Carey at the top and then you can sort of filter down from there. But what I would be doing, and again, this goes to the selection of the team, and it's not because we spoke to him yesterday, but Usman Khawaja is the best option in Australian cricket to be opening the batting with Aaron Finch. And that's been proven over a long period of time in domestic one-day cricket, and has also been proven in what he's been able to do in Big Bash cricket opening the batting. He's not doing it, in my view. Now, he didn't say it yesterday because of his fielding. I think that's the problem that Justin Langer has, and his intensity and his training. But that worries me a little bit if he's just being put to the side because of that, because he's a dynamic batsman.
So to both play, going back a couple of steps, Short and Head, do both of them play, or does one of them miss out for your restructuring of the batting lineup? Because then,
I wouldn't have Darcy Short in the team. I don't think he's done enough in 50-over cricket to suggest that he's the answer. He had a wonderful Big Bash summer, and that's opening the batting. He had a poor IPL because he can't play spin. And so if he's going to play one-day cricket, he's got to be at the top of the order, and I understand that.
But isn't this the time to trial these things? Isn't what we discussed in the build-up to this series was a chance to see what we had?
But yeah, absolutely, Huff. But don't trick things up at the expense of your best buyer. Because what worries me is that Aaron Finch could find himself out of the team if he's not careful, because he's being stuffed around. I think he's got the capability of batting five in T20 cricket, but I just think in one-day cricket with such an inexperienced team, put him at the top, give him some leadership, give him some responsibility, and other players can play around him. I mean, Travis Head can bat four. Travis Head can bat five or six if required.
Is part of Short's advantage being under Langer's coaching at Western Australia that he actually values his leg spin a little bit more at one-day cricket?
Potentially, and I think it's a really good point, Jimmy, and this will sound really stupid, but I reckon there's a real chance that Darcy Short could be playing Test cricket within 12 months, batting six or seven and bowling, as that sort of second spinning option. But I just think...
So is that why the long game's being played using one-day cricket like it used to be to give him that run into Test cricket?
Maybe, Jimmy. But again, I'd still like to see him do it at Sheffield Shield cricket because he was starting to get that opportunity. But... Half, it's one of those things that slightly concerns me a little bit is that Langer's going to a lot of these West Australians. Goes with what he knows. Sean Marsh is back in the team. There's feelings that Mitch Marsh is going to be rushed straight back in, maybe even as vice-captain. And, Jai Richardson's in the team at the moment, who I think is a talented player and was getting some opportunities before Langer came along. But it just worries me a little bit. Maxwell batting low, he should be at four. This isn't a Victoria Western Australia thing. I just think it's interesting how it's playing out at the moment.
Well, I think my concern is that there's too many of the same. If you're going to have Darcy Short as one of your spinning options, you've got Travis Head and Glenn Maxwell as your other spinning batting options.
Plus Agar batting seven.
Plus Agar, who's a specialist who can actually absolutely bat. I put him in a different category because I think he's more accomplished than the other three. But they're three of almost like for like. And is that too many?
It is too many. And so one has to miss out or be sort of sacrificed, and I think that's what's happening with Finch.
I don't like seeing too many guys who are average at both skills side. You can have a couple who can give you a bit with the bat and the ball, but you still need legitimate top order batsmen and some legitimate bowlers. Does that make sense?
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. I mean, look, Sean Marsh made 100 and batted beautifully in that second game, but he was very fortunate to be in the team in the first place. But he's taken his opportunity now. But it's just sometimes you can just make things a lot harder than what they need to be, and I think they've done that in this situation.
Benny Hayes is part of the family here on The Breakfast Club, but he's over at the Royal Ascot Carnival getting ready to watch a Redkirk Warrior dominate on the global stage. He's been good enough to join us. G'day, Benny.
Good morning, boys. How are you?
We are very, very well, mate. How's the world over there for a handsome young trainer travelling the globe?
Well, it's 9:20 at night, and we're definitely... few drinks down, but it's having a good night, and we're just finishing off there. I'm really enjoying the experience.
How big's the team over there from the Hayes Dabbinig Yard?
So we got the big boss.
Oh, the big boss.
D.A. Hayes, and big boss. And then we got Tom's back in Melbourne, and I'm here as well.
Ben, can you just explain to people back here how big the Royal Ascot meeting is?
I'd put it as good as the Spring Carnival. It's absolutely huge. And the amount of press that are interested in the Australian horses at the moment, it's absolutely incredible. And it's one of those unique carnivals. You dress up in your top hat and tails, and it's really got an air of, it's fantastic. I'd put it on par with the Spring Racing Carnival.
And just what you're learning as a trainer, Ben? just with this experience?
Yeah, so I've been really lucky. I've actually done two seasons over here when I was learning. I did one summer with Charlie Hills, who works in Lambourne, which is a different area to where Redcats at the moment. And then I did a summer with John Gosden as a pupil assistant. And he trains out in Newmarket. So I've had quite a bit of experience over here in England, made good friends. And, no, it's good. I'm learning a lot. You never know exactly what you're doing as a trainer. You learn on the job.
And is it helping you with that experience that you've had? I mean, the difference here is that you're travelling a horse, obviously, from Australia across to Ascot, and he's such a brilliant horse. Has that experience helped you, or is travelling horses completely different?
No. I had experience 3 years ago with Criterion.
Oh,
so he raced in Hong Kong. Yep, and then he had a couple of starts over here at Ascot. So I've actually done it before, and we've learnt from mistakes, and hopefully we'll get it right this Saturday.
Ben, just further that, and you compared it to the spring racing carnival here. What's the pressure like, the focus on every single race and even the fields that front up day in, day out?
Yeah, it's very unique. They race 5 days in a row, and it's the best of the best of all of England, and they also get internationals from America. And we're the only Australian international, so the pressure's double. Whole of Australia expects Redcats to run well. Dad and I and Tom really feel the pressure. But the good news is he's travelled over really well. We're thrilled with his gallop on Saturday. And we really think he'll run well next Saturday.
Did I read correctly that you might have the great Frankie Dettori on board?
Yes, you read correctly. He's a fantastic jockey. He's ridden 56 winners at Ascot. The most winners anyone's ever ridden, and he knows the jockeys, he knows the track, and I couldn't think of anyone better to ride the horse.
Sounds like a pretty good combination to me, Ben. And Redkirk Warrior himself, what's the interest like from the press over there? Because 4 years ago, he won his maiden at Ascot, and he went on, was a stayer at the time. He's come back to Australia and been recast as a sprinter. You found the sprinting gene in him. He's won multiple Group 1s. He's heading back to the Diamond Jubilee, the biggest race for sprinters during the Ascot Carnival. What's the coverage been like for him?
Really good. The English press have really loved the story that he won his first two races over 2,000 metres. And now he's coming back as one of Australia's top sprinters to Ascot to home score. So there's been a lot of interest in him, and I think he deserves it because he raced in Hong Kong. He almost got retired. They sent him to Australia hoping to prolong his career, and Arsaria Jules, he did a fantastic job, and he fixed his feet. So he's actually got a really unique, nice story. So English press definitely interested in the horse, and I've done plenty of interviews, that's for sure.
Max Gorn is with us. Big Max, good morning.
Good morning, boys. Thanks for having me.
Pleasure to have you on board. Weekend off for you, a little couple of days off. What'd you do? Freshen up?
Yeah, and I'll say sorry in advance. If you ask me any general football questions, I did not watch 1 minute, so I won't be able to help.
Right, yeah.
I went to Sydney for all four of the days. A little bit left field. Not many people just go to a city. They more go to the sunny beaches, but stayed in Bondi and had a pretty good time.
So how'd you break your week up? Some clubs like to get the team back in, do the review, flog them to death, send them 4 days, or the other way around, you had your rest early in the week?
Well, because we got a Friday night game this week, so which means we had to be back by Sunday. So we had the review straight away on the straight after the game on the Monday.
Straight after the game.
Yeah. And then Tuesday we had a sort of a clinics day. That's the day they like to stick a primary school visits in and whatnot, which was good. And then Wednesday, Thursday, Friday, Saturday off.
Who cuts the vision straight after the game? That's a good effort.
Yeah, we had about half an hour of recovery and then we come back in. So
the
coaches sat in there for half an hour. We've done it twice. The first time was after a win, so that was a little bit easier.
Yeah.
But this one, it was good.
A few cans after the win, just
no
skylarking.
Funny that I did go to Sydney and watch a bit of the NRL. It's amazing that straight after the game, they've all got a beer in the circle. It's something that's gone out of football, but NRL is still holding us proud.
We can start a campaign to get it back, mate, if you like.
I might just see what it's like.
Beer in a jaffle.
Just get a can open in the middle.
Beer in a jaffle. Beer in a jaffle. There you go.
We got to talk jaffles again.
We're always talking jaffles.
What was it like doing a review straight after a game? Like, was it different because the coaches don't have the time to get all the vision ready and all that sort of thing? Like, was it a shorter version? Was it a better version?
It's probably a more emotional version.
Yeah.
So there's definitely emotions from the players and coaches that haven't been able to have a bottle of red and sleep on or whatnot. So it's still quite vocal. And the good thing was it was the mid-season review as well. And sometimes you can take in potentially just the Collingwood game and just talk about the Collingwood game. But you got to look at the bigger picture, and we're 8-4, and we did win six in a row there. And so you can't. Obviously, it's not all bad news going into the bye, but we managed to finish on a good note in the review, and we're all relatively positive for this week.
We haven't seen you since. What did you take out of the Collingwood game?
I knew Collingwood was going to be a pretty hard team to play, and some incredible speed and some really good midfielders, and they got the jump on us again like they have the last couple of times we played them, and we just never brought that margin back. I think it stayed there for the whole game, so a bit disappointing, but we learned a few things, and hopefully we can bring it against Port Adelaide this week.
You talk about the mid-season analysis you had after the game. Johnny Ralph's got one of those in the Herald Sun today. He's given you an A-. Where is that about right for where your expectations were at the start of the season? Are you an A-, or are you above or below that, do you reckon, just personally?
Anything with an A is more than we normally get. normally I see an F there. so we're progressing. I'm not sure where we should have been, but we're 8-4, and after a pretty disappointing start, we're losing to Hawthorn and Richmond, getting spanked by Hawthorn and Richmond at probably somewhere that I didn't think we'd probably be. So to get there is good. We got a relatively hard part of the draw, especially these next sort of 4 or 5 weeks. So, starting with Port at Adelaide Oval on Friday night, so it's going to be exciting.
Were those losses against Adelaide and Hawthorn brought up in the mid-season review, and as maybe a catalyst to get you to where you are now, 8-4, which is a really handy position, just by the way? Were they mentioned in the review?
Because we did win 6 in a row from there.
Yeah.
If you want to put a negative part on a review, which you have to look at both sides, you have to go back to those two games because they're our last two losses. So they're always brought up as more than the Geelong game in round one, because that one's further past.
Yep.
But you go to your most recent losses, and that's Hawthorn and Richmond, so that's why they always get brought up.
But that would be the catalyst for maybe the turnaround, perhaps? The analysis of those and the learnings from those two matches, perhaps, do you think?
Yeah, and to be honest, with Doggies and Collingwood the last 2 weeks, we've sort of gone back a little bit.
Mm.
So the last 2 weeks, we've been able to look into what we did after Hawthorn Richmond. So seems like every sort of 4 or 5 weeks, you'd be able to, hopefully, we can just go 10 in a row from here on in. But there's going to be times when you have down performances, and
yep,
you can really review that and get better.
Does the critiquing change now that there's greater expectation on this group?
I'm still not sure if there's greater expectation on us, especially from round one. Round one, there was probably the most expectation ever. I feel like it's almost gone down, which is good. But the group's really performed incredibly well in the smaller games this year, and unfortunately, we haven't played well in the Anzac Day Eve game or the Queen's Birthday game. So that's something we could probably work on going into, especially the two Adelaide Oval games we got this year. So that's coming up. So they're big games, and hopefully we can perform in them.
The sort of question from a different angle, do you think that other clubs are now critiquing you a little more forensically and really sort of trying to work out what are you doing well? And have you detected that in the last potentially couple of weeks?
I mean, if you're in the professional environment, you should be critiquing all teams, especially if you're coming up against them. But the teams we've lost to, for example, Collingwood and Richmond play very similar football, and we've lost to them, so they've obviously done their homework on how we like to play, and the way they play has been able to hold up. So that's something we got to do next time we play Collingwood or Richmond or a team that plays similar football. You could take all 18 teams as much as each other.
Because we've been talking a bit in the last couple of weeks about Melbourne, about the clearance issues that you had against the Bulldogs, which didn't affect obviously the scoreboard, but certainly the Collingwood game. That maybe other clubs have been doing things differently against you in that sort of stoppage situation?
Yeah, we've been, there's some different stuff going on. Collingwood, we just really let ourselves down. And to be fair to Collingwood, they really played some good football in there. So where Western Bulldogs threw a lot at us, that's probably, we could probably put it on that. But yeah, Collingwood, our craft wasn't there. Intensity around the ball wasn't there. So that's probably why Collingwood smashed us. But Hawthorn and Richmond, we go back to it again. Those two losses were big clearance losses as well. And then we managed to have a little sort of point in the road there and be able to go forward. So hopefully we can do that again.
Sorry, Jimmy, just on that way, just to pick up on that. Do you see yourself as the captain of the stoppages because you're the ruckman, or is that, you've obviously got experience with Viney and Jones, your two club captains. Who's the one that sort of takes the responsibility and say, right, okay, we've got to do something different here because this is affecting our chance of winning?
It's quite... Ruckman always seem to be able to say where they want to hit the ball, which is quite weird because midfielders should get a say. And our midfield's got two captains.
Yeah.
A lot of chefs.
When it comes to the centre bounce, it seems to be my decision on where we go, which I don't know how that happened and why that landed on me, but which is good. But
you're the one's got to get it there.
Yeah, but it's a very vocal midfield. So we got obviously the two skippers, and they're skippers for a reason. So... and then I'm leadership group, and then Louis is the other leadership group member who is in and out of the midfield. So it can be a very talkative midfield, but it works well. It works well having that many voices and that many opinions, and being able to, we're getting better at being able to pick the right one.
So, because Cameron Ling was your captain of the footy team there for a while.
Yep.
Does that necessarily make him the architect of the stoppage?
Oh, he was certainly very good at it. He was even... From his early ages, Lingy was very good at coming to a stoppage and barking out orders. He was very comfortable in doing that because Lingy often coming to a stoppage had someone.
Just hanging off jumpers is all he was doing.
He was piggybacking him. Yeah, he put the big red clamps on. So he was able to set his position, and we wanted him to help set us because we're trying to help Lingy stop the best player. So often he'd...
It's almost like a reference.
Yeah, he was our reference point. Yeah. So that's a great way of putting it. He'd come to the stoppage because normally he was fitter than the rest of us, and we were all... the big guy could run. So he'd get there and go, look, there's the space. But then you'd swing straight around, and Brad Otten's would just be quick little point. That's where it's going, and away we went.
Well, that's the other reference. The other reference is where a ruckman can get the ball. So you can base it around where the ball's going, or if Lingy's tagging, where he's going to set up.
Yeah, so they were our two, and... Yeah, we had Brad Ottens and Stephen King, who were very knowledgeable and very good ruckmen. So they were pretty honest. That's the point as well with your ruckman. You don't want, Max, some buff-headed ruckman who think, I'm going to win every hit-out. And you go, you're not winning a single hit-out here. We're not listening to you. But, Max, I wanted to ask you, you talked about reviewing and other teams reviewing. What are the good sides doing this year? Has it changed? And how can Melbourne improve after seeing these good sides doing it?
Probably hasn't necessarily changed. I feel like forward momentum and playing the ball in your forward half has been something that's been going on for a few years, but the best teams do it the best. So Richmond's ability, and they're wet weather specialists almost in a way, because they just keep surging the ball forward. Yep. And Colin would have brought that in this year with a little bit of speed up forward as well. So it seems to be how good you are at sort of strangling a team and keeping them in your forward half and then just surging the ball forward.
It's working pretty well for the Tigers. Did you watch the game on whenever that was, Sunday?
I won't be able to help.
That's all right. I wasn't looking for forensic analysis. I was just a random question. Let's take me back to Sydney then. What's the expectation for you guys when you have your break? Is there expectation to just shut down and do nothing, or are you supposed to be moving and doing stuff while you're on your break?
Most people who would be AFL players would hate to sit down for longer than 6-7 hours or do nothing anyway. So I think most people are going to go out there for a jog or a swim, and that's expected of them as well. So there is a little program. Of course, I'm going to run topless down Bondi Beach. So I managed to definitely put that one in.
Well, wouldn't you?
And kick a footy to make sure your legs don't go, because it's, in the end, it's just 4 days off in the middle of the year. It's not Bali at the end of the season or anything like that. So we've got 10 or 11 more games to play this season, and hopefully get ourselves ready for some finals.
Do you feel fresher mentally or physically?
It never really affects me. I just take the 4 days because they're there. I don't necessarily, I'm not necessarily begging for the buy.
Yeah, okay. I'm surprised by that, I say, considering your position and how hard you've worked and the time of on ground you play, that you were pretty good to go still.
Yeah, so I would have quite happily gone for the next 10 games, but I'll be careful what I say because the PA do want the buy and they're pushing for a second, so I'll make sure I pump it up.
Is that because you like routine, or is it that you have a much, I've got to be careful what I say here, a much more balanced approach to life? Because I think a lot of guys feel that they need the mental break, is sort of what Half was alluding to, because of the intensity of being an AFL footballer. But is that because they take it maybe a bit too seriously, or...?
It's definitely more of a mental break for the people who are so footy-centric, and it's easy to be footy-centric, especially in your first couple of years. It's a full-time job, and it's written about in the media. It's talked about amongst your family and friends, so it's pretty crazy. But at my age and the amount of games that I've played, it's probably more the physical freshness, but I didn't think I really needed it this year. So, but the mental break can come as well, but I didn't really get it because I probably have that better life balance.
If you've got a shot of Max top off on Bondi, send it through 0416 90 50 52.
Running slow mo.
Running slow mo. We've got the video of the slow mo, the Baywatch style situation.
The life boy under the.
Well, one man who knows about score involvements and intensity and affecting contest is Dane Zorko, the captain of the Brisbane Lions, who's been good enough to join us around the grounds on the Breakfast Club. Good morning, Dane.
Morning, guys. How are we?
We are very well. How are you, more importantly? You're fresh, you're vibrant, you're ready to roll?
Yeah, going well. We've had the weekend off, so ready to go.
We just had Big Maxi Gorn in here from the D's, and we asked him what he was up to. He went to Sydney, popped into Sydney to say good day. Where do you go when you live in sunshine?
That's right.
Yeah. Well, I was a little bit different this year, and being the Aussie ambassador up in Queensland, I actually got out to Western Queensland and did a couple of Aussie clinics on my Thursday and Friday. So something a little bit different, but really enjoyable. And then the little fella's turning 2 on Thursday, so the weekend was dedicated to him and his second birthday and SeaWorld and all the fun stuff. So it was a pretty busy weekend, to be honest, but nice and refreshing that the body can have a good break.
What have you put in his hand leading up to second birthday? Is it a football, a soccer ball, golf clubs?
It's a combination of all three, to be honest, mate. he's had a fair crack at all of them. He sleeps with his footy, though, so I think we might have another footballer, although I've really been pushing that golf club and helping him put the tee in the ground for the golf ball and sticking the golf ball on top and whacking it. So he's getting there, but I think it's football at the moment.
Oh, beautiful. We asked Max about the buy, and he said it was a good chance for Melbourne to do a review of the season so far. Did Brisbane do something similar?
We did. We did. We did that yesterday afternoon, and we had a really good look at our first 11 rounds, 12 rounds. And the positive sign for us is we certainly improved in all areas that we wanted to from last year, which was really positive. But we understand that there's still a really large improvement and a lot of areas still that we can get a lot better at. So it was pleasing to see that we've certainly made improvements. The win-loss column probably doesn't show that. But we certainly feel, and the statistics certainly show, that we are certainly a better side than what we were last year, which is really great.
Can you drill down on that for us a little bit more? If there's one thing that you're really focused on improving, and then also the one thing that you feel like you guys as a group are doing really well?
Well, I think defensively, I think in 2016 we conceded somewhere around 130 points a game. Last year we cut that down to 115, and presently we sit at 96 points. So it's a bit to stopping the opposition scoring and defensively. It's been really, really, really good for us so far. But to get that number under 100, really positive. So that's probably one of the biggest areas. So certainly defensive. I think that gives us a chance in the game as well. And then I think a room for improvement is probably still that contested possession. We worked really hard over it in the pre-season, but we've probably lapsed in 10, 15-minute periods when the game's probably got away from us in those periods. So that's probably the area that we certainly need to clean up heading into the back half of the season.
Just talking about keeping teams to a score and how it's come from 130 to 15 to 96, is there a number you want to get it to?
Under 100, certainly, the area that we're looking at. But we obviously judge everything off the premiership window and where the premiers have been the years before. So I think anywhere under 85-90 is a really competitive total. And then obviously you've got to score more. But I think that's somewhere that the premiers have been able to consistently keep their opposition under. Over the last 5-6 years anyway that we've been looking at it.
What do you want to get out of the second half of the year, Dane? As you said, there's been so many improvements made, and I think we've all seen that, just in game style, individuals, etc. Do you put a number on how many games you want to win, or is it just about improvement and sort of setting up a foundation for the future, I guess?
Oh, we'd absolutely love to win a lot more games. But I think what important is for us is to make sure that McGladish, Berry, Witherden, Bailey and Rayner, they get those 10 games now. The other boys are at 20. Get them up to 30. Get the other boys up to 25. Really keep drilling in, really getting the games into them and trying to get them playing some consistent AFL football, which will certainly hold us in good stead as the year goes on. So I think that's probably the most important thing for us, and getting our process right. A lot of people talk about it, but it really is important. We work all throughout the pre-season, all throughout the year, to implement a process that should hold up on game day. So it's really important that we execute that as best as possible. And if we know that we do that, then the wins will certainly come.
Dane, how do you handle that? You know, you drive home from a game and you said you've got to wait for players to get the 10 games, others to 25 and 30. How do you handle that as a senior player who obviously you always want to win now?
Yeah, it's a good question. It's certainly frustrating, but I've over the years I've certainly understood, and I can see a really clear direction in which the club's going right now, and that's something I've spoken to Fags about constantly. I'm really positive and bullish about where the club's going and the future that we hold. So, yes, it's disappointing that we're not winning the games at the moment, and a little bit frustrating because we're certainly in games to win and we're just not doing it at the moment. But I can certainly see the light at the end of the tunnel, and that's probably the pleasing thing. And that keeps me coming in energetic and wanting to help the boys get better and improve and get that climb up the ladder as quick as possible.
In fear of putting words in your mouth, I'll ask the question this way. You've been at the club now a long time. Is it the most exciting you felt and the most sort of confident you felt that the club's in the right hands and heading in the right direction?
Yes. To be perfectly honest, yes. Yeah, it's just a different feel around the club. Things upstairs are going well, things downstairs are going well. You can see that the club's heading in a really strong direction. I mean, we don't really like to use outside noise, but there's certainly been a lot of talk around the competition, and Fraser have reiterated that other coaches have praised him, that, you know, the boys are going really well, and they can certainly see we're on the right direction. So that's certainly reassuring, and by far it's probably been the most exciting period at the club for myself since I've been there.
Guidelines around intentional umpire contact are not specific. At match review level, we've decided to interpret those guidelines for intentional umpire contact as being when a player disrespectfully, aggressively, dismissively, or indeed forcefully, intentionally touches an umpire.
Do you change the rules?
No, what we're doing is trying to interpret the rules that as they are laid down. As I said earlier, they are not specific with respect to being able to explain exactly what the guidelines actually mean with respect to intentional and also careless umpire contact.
That's a great question midway through. You say change the rules.
That's very funny.
Scotty Gallen's with us from the Herald Sun. That was Michael Christian, the MRO, discussing the Dustin Martin outcome yesterday. Just a fine for Dusty, and he's good to go this week for the Tigers, even though they've got a bye. So he'll be good to go next week for the Tigers. Scotty, welcome.
Thank you, Daniel.
You as clear as mud, or are you happy with that outcome yesterday with Dusty?
No, I think...
By the way, I'll tell you, I think it's the right outcome.
Of course it's the right outcome. I mean, you don't want people suspended for that. You know I'm big on that. I don't want anyone suspended ever. But the facts are we've gone away from whatever round it was where any contact was the end of the world and you shouldn't play again, to now we've got degrees of contact,
the spirit of the law is being interpreted here.
Yeah, but it's a complete change of narrative.
Yes, it is. Absolutely.
Yeah, because it was black and white.
I got it wrong initially.
But because it was black and white. Now it's, as you said, the spirit of it.
Mm. So now it's you can push, shove, bump them, but if it's in a jocular way, James, it's yes. Okay. Scotty. If it's in a, that was a bad decision, well, that's angry towards me, you might get a week.
And that makes sense, doesn't it?
Well, it does, but... Why don't you own up? Instead, they try and spin it. Poor Christo should have gone, look, we got X wrong, whichever one, that list of the two or three we got, and now we're the tribunal's told us this is ridiculous, you sorted out your end, and we are.
But what ones...
I don't think they've got any wrong. It's no, just the way they sent the message.
Yeah, correct.
Well, hang on. Ed Curno, why did he get suspended for his?
Because he pushed him away.
Well, what did Dusty do? He's showing him a bump. That pushed him away.
Well, that was like the Stephen May incident where he described it showing an incident or displaying an incident. They're very different scenarios as far as I'm concerned.
Yeah. So I think they've been consistent in all of them. The outcomes. Now, they had to put sort of Hawkins up as a bit of a test case to see what would come back. The issue is all around the system. The system is inflexible, so Crisso makes it flexible. And the outcome's always right, but he has to do a little bit of manipulation and sort of cajoling to get the outcome.
Great word.
Very good jumper.
It is a very good jumper. I'm really happy with it.
Oh, seriously. I hope you got so five warm. Of them in different colours.
Maybe revisiting the... I just think that... Now you got me off track.
So my apologies.
I think it's an inflexible system the way it's set up. So you've got to start manipulating things to get the outcome you want. But no one wants Dustin Martin suspended for that. No. I feel there's a bit of a witch hunt going on now, that it's almost like people are trying to find ways of suspending. Oh, he made contact.
It's a blood sport. I've been telling you this for years.
It sits really uncomfortably with me, that.
I've been telling you this for years. Everyone wants everyone suspended.
Yeah.
Well, you know who's leading the way.
Who's that?
Amy. Steve O'Time likes it. He's one of those.
Scan TVs.
I spoke to Scan TV. And a few of his pals, they love that. Bang. Straight on it.
Drives traffic.
But this is the problem, is this clickbait society now. It just annoys the hell out of me.
Well, I couldn't agree more.
But what about how Crisso spoke to the ump and he said, all good? The ump in every occasion has said, yeah, I didn't think there was anything in it. Well, in all the cases.
Some of them said they didn't even notice it.
Yeah. So, but now we're taking the ump saying, oh, no, it was a friendly chat.
We like friendly chats.
But it's like with the...
just changing.
It's like with the diving thing, and I know you want to talk about Damien Hardwick and his outrage around the commentary with Alex Rance, but this is what happens, that there is an incident. So now every time Alex Rance goes for the ball, he's forensically investigated as to whether he's legitimately diving for the ball or whether he's, you know, trying to act or whether he's being pushed. Alex Rance hasn't played his football any differently in the 10 years he's played, and he plays at a very high level.
A very high level. Yeah. Extraordinarily high
level.
The
only issue with Dimas Sprain, I've got no problem with it, because I agree. I mean, highlighting Rance has gone over the top.
Highlighting anyone for free kicks, and this, as we're calling it, a witch hunt for did he dive, did he milk a free kick, is one of the most boring conversations in football.
Totally agree. But he was fined for the first incident. So hence, it's a topic that can be spoken about.
Yeah, yep.
So Dima blowing up at everyone talking.
Why do we care so much?
No, it was the I don't think he would have had an issue with that so much as the conversation surrounding that. Like there was stains on his legacy. Yes. It was disgraceful. It was embarrassing. These are the words that were being used.
If he continues his career, will be forever.
Yeah, these are the words that were being used in the discussion, which was just so far out of whack. It's not funny.
I agree with you.
This is why it goes back to your point about the witch hunt blood sport situation. People just looking to just hang people for something.
Because how it happens is because he was fined, the feeling is, well, if he does it again, he's going to be suspended. So he's walking a tightrope. He's on the edge. And anything that could happen, he's going to get suspended for it. Like, and everyone gets so emotionally involved.
They're at the starter's gates for outrage, like chomping at the bit.
There it is.
Hey, while we're talking about umpiring,
yes,
the total amount of 50-metre penalties, are we doing two laps around of Australia?
Your man, Michael Warner, who's one of the greats, has got a magnificent little diagram in the Herald Sun.
Not a very good pool player, though, my understanding is.
Not when the pressure's on. Last year, at this time, we could have gone from the MCG to Wattle Park. Again, this is out of my zone. I don't know where these places
are. Wattle Park's just near my place. Perfect. Beautiful
but
place.
But now you can go to Oakley, which is apparently a lot further away.
It's about 4 or 3.5 k's away.
There's been 73 more. That's a lot of 50-metre penalties.
Because of encroachment.
Yeah, which there was one. Was it the Geelong game?
Yeah, where he came from behind the mark.
He ran to get on the mark.
Yeah, but you can't come from behind
but he didn't
the mark.
Really. He was sort of running with the
Well, you
play.
Either did or you didn't, which you
well,
did.
Well, I'd suggest it was another.
So what's his alternative
decision.
Then, Jimmy?
Yeah.
What? No, we'll just have no one on the mark?
And just stand there and, like a statue and go, I'm not allowed to go to the mark?
So this is the problem. You argue with people on their opinion. The rule is the rule.
Yeah. No, I understand
no,
that.
But it's adjudication what,
yeah, you
of
can't,
the rule.
Yeah, you can't come from behind the man
but
on the mark.
But he didn't. He was in the flow of play.
No, he wasn't. He came from behind. You can... Try and see things that
what's it like? So how is the mark going to be manned then?
It's bad luck. That's
so
what
he can't run from behind.
No, because that's what they're trying to get away from is people running from behind the mark.
What was the bloke supposed to do?
He can't man the mark. That's
so he just stands still.
He's not entitled to man the mark.
It's like somebody. Which way does he run? The other way.
No, he's got to get out.
He's got to get out of that zone.
I don't agree with
the players in GUR. He can't go in the area.
But it was
Scott.
It wasn't a late one. Like
no. But you can't run from behind the guy who has the ball to mark. I'm not saying it's a good rule, but the way the rule is...
Well, it's like common sense needs to be adjudicated.
No, but it's not.
But the umpires don't have that provision. Yes, common sense. They have to umpire the
Everyone in the world has common sense.
No, but Scotty, but this is the whole thing. It's the same with the tribunal or match review panel as with common officiating sense. Umpires. The umpires and Chriso are working within a set of guidelines.
Yeah, whether you like it or not.
The guidelines are the issue.
It's like the sliding one. We might all hate it, but the rule is there.
It's not the umpire's fault.
Well, they have to call it.
Every rule should have an asterisk of common sense. Overriding sense.
You can't bring personal opinion like that into it.
Well, they're asked to adjudicate on everything. So
with the rules that they've got in front of them.
Let's speak about some good news.
No.
Good news.
I'm with you, though. I'm agreeing with you, though.
We agree with you in the sentiment of the rule is crap, but the rule is the rule currently. Hunter Clark getting the Saints Rising Star nod. It was a big weekend for the Saints. They came from the clouds to defeat the Gold Coast. And now, one of their top 10 picks, number 7, in fact, Hunter Clark is the Rising Star.
Well, there's a fair bit of pressure on their draft, as we know, and their list manager got the flick. But they went with two high picks last year, and Hunter Clark was one of them. And
Caulfield was
pick eight. Caulfield,
who's pick Caulfield. Number 8.
Caulfield's a good player.
Yeah, he's in the Magoos, though, so he's not going that great. But Hunter Clark's going beautifully, and his poise and handball. Yeah, when the heat was on and the Richo, the heat was well and truly on him, it was very impressive. So it's a great result for them, given what they've been through, and he looks like a serious player. Good size. He's a bit taller, the taller mid that we love.
Yeah, with the right development, he will be a serious player for a long time. He can kick left and right foot really well. He's, super balanced around the contest.
Excellent hands as well.
I like that he had to go home to look after his siblings because the parents were in Bali for the bye, so he had to rush home. Poor old Hunter.
He's a good boy.
A 17-year-old and a 13-year-old. Good luck looking after them. It'd be anarchy at the Clark House.
It'd be Fortnite on the Xbox. That's what it would
be. I don't think St Kilda is in nearly as bad a shape as what others think.
Oh. So one miracle comeback win.
I'm not talking about Saturday at all.
You're talking future
planning.
I think
they're in a world of pain.
Yep. If they go about it the right way, I don't think it'll be as bad as what people think.
It's been fascinating viewing for the 4 days of the US Open. In fact, Mike Clayton, one of the most prominent voices in Australian golf, has been good enough to join us to talk us through what he saw. Good morning, Mike.
Morning, guys.
To borrow a couple of lines from your latest article on the Golf Australia website, the US Open's always been about setting the most brutal test possible, one not arranged to humiliate the best players, but rather to identify them. As Sandy Tatum said in the 1974 Open, winged foot. Did they do either?
Well, they did everything last week. They kind of humiliated them on Saturday when the course got out of control and was silly. I guess they identify... I mean, the US Open always identifies tremendous... nearly always identifies great players because it's the US Open. People choke. It's the biggest tournament. So only the guys at the end of the guys that get there at the end have all played great golf. And they're tough, hard players. So Curtis Strange, the last guy to go back-to-back. Koepka, he doesn't seem like a historic player yet, because sure he's won two US Opens, which is amazingly historic, a team and only five or six players have done it. But he hasn't won anything else, really. He's won one other tournament. But he's a tremendous player, unbelievably strong. People talk about him being the modern archetypal type player who hits the ball forever, massive club head speed. Goes to the gym and he can play AFL football and beat the hell out of it. So, an interesting player. And you could argue that the tournament identified the best player. I'm not sure that that's true, but that's the case a lot of weeks. But certainly it was controversial and it was... The result was certainly dictated and manipulated negatively by what happened on Saturday.
Yeah, and that seemed to be the big talking point throughout the weekend. How did they lose it? What happened?
Well, the core of the issue, as the article points out, is the USGA's obsession with having Parr win the tournament, and the ball going too fast. So they've got to manipulate the golf course to achieve that because the ball goes a crazy distance. So they get greens on the edge, and unbelievably fast. They get them hard. The wind gets up, and the ball, it wouldn't stay on the greens. There were pins that were ridiculously difficult. So in trying to manipulate part of wind, they distort the dimensions of the golf course because the ball's a problem. So that's the root cause of it. But, I mean, they lost it because of their own self-admitted incompetence. They knew the wind was coming, yet they brought the greens right to the very edge. So when the wind started blowing at 20 miles an hour, they went over it. Mm-hmm. And, it's not the first time it's happened. It's happened here in Australia. It's happened... It's really, really, really happened at the British Open. They stopped play at St Andrews in 2015 because of the wind. But it's a problem that we in Australia have had, and they have in America, because they're obsessed with rock-hard fast greens.
In saying that, Mike, the three big conversations that have come out of this tournament, which is gaining the most traction? Is it the course? Is it we've got a back-to-back champion, or is it the Phil Mickelson saga, I guess?
Well, the course should never be the story. The course should be the story at the start of the week, but the players should be the story at the end of the week. And the players on Saturday weren't the story. It was the golf course, and the golf course shouldn't have been, because it's a great course and it's an amazing place. But they messed with the setup too much, I think. And the Mickelson thing was just silly. I don't, it was clearly a brain fade. For the guy who's supposed to be a master spin, he clearly spun himself further into the shit, not out of it. I mean, it was ridiculous. I mean, if he said, "I lost my head," it was ridiculous. Everyone would have said, "Fair enough, okay." But
should he have been disqualified?
Well,
I know technically it's more of the spirit of the thing, but should he have been DQ? Yeah.
Well, I don't know. I mean, arguably. I mean, the thing is, as someone brought up, what happens if that happens to Augusta when your ball's going in the water at the 15th hole? And if it goes in the water, you've got to go and chip it back, just go and stop it and take a two-shot penalty. Well, that's the can of worms that no one wants to open, because that ought to be a DQ. So they argued that he didn't stop or deflect the ball. Now, that's semantics. I mean, he clearly stopped it where it was going to go to. And if you're playing cricket and someone bowls at you and you catch the edge of the bat and deflect it somewhere, that's a deflection. Well, looks to me like he either stopped or deflected or both, but somehow they wormed their way out of it and kept him in the field. I mean, I think he should have just DQ'd himself. He should have rang up and said, "I'm out." Clearly, upset a lot of people. I went far too far. It was crazy what I did. I'm not going to play. Or play and donate his prize money to someone who's more worthy of it than he was last week.
Yeah, I couldn't agree with you more. Mike, just looking at the two questions I've got for you. Shinnecock Hills, it's seen as one of the most famous golf courses in the world when it's set up properly. As a golf architect, do you get, and a historian of the game, do you get upset and angry that they set it up the way they did?
Well, disappointing. What I get upset and angry about is the people who set it up, the ones who've got the power to control the ball, which is out of control. And if they controlled the ball, they wouldn't have to set it up the way they did. That's what I get disappointed and angry at, or mad and angry at. I think they had a bad day. They screwed up. They admitted it. Okay, move on. But it's not a problem that's going to go away. We're going to continue to see. I mean, last year, the course that kept Kawanon was almost 8,000 yards long. And he shot 16 under par because the wind didn't blow. So clearly, length is not a way to solve the issue. I mean, just making courses longer and longer is no solution to anything. I mean, Royal Melbourne doesn't have 1,000 yards to find unless they go and buy up a whole of Black Rock. But, which Augusta would do, but Royal Melbourne don't have the finances of Augusta. But, I mean, my issue is with the people who run the game and their failure to regulate it properly.
Do you think players are now starting to understand that maybe technology has to be reeled in because we're having these situations, as you said, where tournament organisers are having to try and trick up courses to try and keep things in control, in perspective?
Well, Billy clearly doesn't. I mean, he's arguing that the ball's going further because the players are better athletes and he's also arguing the ball is not the problem. Well, the ball's one of the issues. So the real problem is the combination of the ball and the driver.
you know, you give a modern player a long, light graphite shaft of the head like a frying pan and a ball that doesn't spin, they'll figure out how to hit it forever.
Yeah.
So you've seen the dominance of the last four players last week and the last two groups, Berger, Koepka, Finau and Johnson, and four of the very longest hitters on tour.
Yeah.
So the game's going to be more and more dominated by guys who are just great athletes, as opposed to players who didn't necessarily hit the ball as far, but had other parts of their game that could allow them, that gave them a chance to compete with the longer hitters.
That was the best of the Breakfast Club. If you want to hear the full interviews again, go straight to the website, rsn.net.au.